I'd like to thank you for that. There's nothing better than starting the day singing of the holiness and the glory and the sovereignty of God. I'd also like to thank you, Dr. White, for the very warm welcome that you have given me, but I'm going to put warm in air quotes. I spent all my life in Pennsylvania until the Keystone State is well represented, until about 5 years ago when I saw the light and made the trek south to palm trees and sunshine and alligators and water moccasins, but we won't talk about those things. It's my pleasure to be here. I have known of Cedarville from a distance for decades and have held this institution in high regard and esteem and appreciate your contributions not only to those circles that you are in, but also to the kingdom, and grateful for the many that have studied here and have gone out and served God, and for the testimony of this university, not only in the United States, but even around the world. And it's a real privilege and honor for me to be here and to be in chapel and to speak to you. In 1530, Luther and a small group left Wittenberg and walked the kilometer or two down to the Elbe River, got in a little boat and went down to Torgau. Torgau was a beautiful, charming city, town, and the castle was built right there along the river. You dock in a few yards and you're inside the castle walls. It was the working home of the Duke of Saxony. Frederick the Wise, you might have heard that name. He was the one who stood with Luther back at the Diet of Worms, but he had died, and now his brother, John the Steadfast. Now, don't you love this family? Frederick the Wise, John the Steadfast. These are really cool names that they give their kids. By now, John the Steadfast is the ruler of Saxel, Germany, and he is there to lead Luther and a group of other theologians to Augsburg to write the Augsburg Confession. They spend a few weeks there at Torgau, and Luther, by and large, drafts the Augsburg Confession. But Luther, he's under the ban. He's been under the ban since the time of the Diet of Worms. And Augsburg is outside of Saxon Germany. It's past John the Steadfast's control and power, so they decide that Luther should not go with them to Augsburg. They make the trip as far as the castle Coburg, and they go on to Augsburg. Luther stays behind. He's holed up in this castle for 6 months. This is a difficult time for Luther. We think of the Diet of Worms and Luther's courageous stand, but this was a very fledgling, tenuous institution, the Reformed Church in Germany. It was precariously poised in 1530, and it could easily go one way or the other. It was surrounded, as you know, by Roman Catholicism, and there was even the threat of Islam coming from the East, and there carved out this little patch of the Protestant, the Reformed Church. But it was incumbent on what would happen at Augsburg for the future and success of this church, and Luther could not be there. This is a guy who has to be in the room. He can't be outside of the room when those important decisions are being made. And not only is he outside of the room, he's miles and miles away at the Castle Coburg. It's a charming place. You should look it up, Google it, the Castle Coburg. Just don't do it now during chapel, do it after chapel. It looks charming. For Luther, it was a time of absolute desperation. And if you know anything about Luther, he was given to extremes. And he always thought anytime he got a sickness that he was going to die. You know, have you heard of this? The man cold? You got to wait till you're married, and then when you're married, you get the man cold. The man cold is when you know you're going to die. You're on the couch, and you just know you're going to die. Of course, you know, 24 hours later, you're full recovery, and you're back to... Luther suffered the man cold all the time. He was given to depression. And here he is at Coburg in absolute anxiety for 6 months. He doesn't just spend the time in depression. He turns to writing, always a distraction for Luther. And in the course of those 6 months, he writes 50 books. 50. Now, some of these are just small little pamphlets, but still, that's an admirable number. And one of them was a treatise on Psalm 118. If you have a Bible, open it to Psalm 118. I actually think Luther Life Verses, that's a sort of 20th century American evangelical thing, but I think if Luther had a life verse, it would be Psalm 118, 17. He certainly came to this text at a significant time in his life when he needed it. And he read this in Psalm 118, verse 17, and later in life, Luther would call this my beloved psalm. And everyone knew what he was talking about. He's talking about Psalm 118. As you're looking at Psalm 118, you see that it opens and ends with the same verse, "Oh, give thanks to the Lord, for he is good. For his steadfast love endures forever." His covenant loyalty bookends to the psalm. And sometimes that literary structure of the bookends points us right to the middle. And that's what this psalm does. And right around in the middle is this verse, verse 17. And it says very simply, "I shall not die, but I shall live and recount the deeds of the Lord." This verse came to Luther at exactly a time when he needed it. He needed the confidence that this verse gave him. See the psalmist wrestling with what he's dealing with. The psalmist always does prior to this verse. He speaks of his enemies around him. He says that he was pushed so hard in verse 13. "I was pushed hard so that I was falling. My enemies were like a swarm of bees around my head." And yet he can take confidence in the Lord and say, "I shall not die." Now, what do we know? Well, the psalmist dies. And what do we know? Luther dies. So it's not this human bravado, "I'll live forever, I shall not die." You know, like you all think, you will just live forever, you'll never get old. Trust me, the time will come. We have a faculty student soccer game down at RBC. And one thing I've observed over just the 5 years that I've been there is that the students always stay the exact same age. They never age. They're always perfect 18 to 22-year-olds who can run for an hour and not grow weary or faint. Whereas each year, we seem to just simply get older. I don't know how that works. Eventually, you too will get older, and you too will not be able to run for an hour straight. Eventually, we die. That's not what the psalmist is saying. "I shall not die. I'm invincible. I'll live forever." The psalmist is saying this: "I'm perfectly, squarely in the center of your will and your care for me. Nothing will befall me that is not only part of your sovereign plan for me, but part of your goodness to me. I shall not die, but I shall live. Confident, not in my strength, not in my human achievement, my human ability to overcome all odds, not in any of that, not in our medical, technological advancements, but firmly confident in God." Luther needed that at 1530. But it becomes his life verse, because not only does he need it at 1530, but he's a preacher. Luther is a parish preacher. He's at St. Mary's Church. There's the two churches in Wittenberg, the Castle Church, the famous doors, the most famous doors in all of history. And then there's Mary's Church, the parish church. He preached there from 1513 until the time of his death, 1546. He preached there before he posted the 95 Theses. He was a parish priest. And this is what he did. He, as the second half of this psalm says, recounted the deeds of the Lord. That was Luther's life. It's not just the pastor's calling, it's all of our calling. We are all called to preach the gospel. Remember when Philip is with the Ethiopian eunuch? The text there says that he preached the gospel to the Ethiopian eunuch. There they are in the carriage, and Philip says, "Hold on, I need to get out the pulpit, and I need to put on my clerical robe." Although you guys are all Baptists, right? You don't wear clerical robes like we Presbyterians wear robes. Let me get out the pulpit. Let me get out the robe. Now I will preach the gospel to you. No, in his ordinary engagement with people, Philip was preaching the gospel. It's not the calling of the pastor to recount the deeds of the Lord. It's incumbent on all of us to proclaim the gospel, confident in God, confident that we are squarely right in his care. Well, not only was this verse important to Luther, but this whole psalm was important to Luther. And as I look at this psalm, and what I want to do with you in the time that we have is use Luther and this psalm to help us read the psalms. And I'll give you three ways that we read the psalms. Number one, we read the psalms personally. We must see ourselves in the psalms. Number two, we read the psalms Christologically. We must see Christ in the Psalms. And thirdly, we read the Psalms theologically, and by that I mean very specifically, we come to the Psalms, is what we just sung, we come to the Psalms to behold our God. We come to the Psalms to see God. And we see God in his fullness only after we come to God through Christ. And we see God in his fullness, and we understand, even just beginning to understand, and we spend our whole lives beginning to understand the greatness of God when we see our true selves and how much we need God and how much we need a God who is so unlike us. We don't need a God like us. We need a mediator like us. Make no mistake about that. We need a God unlike us. And that is the God we meet in the Psalms. Well, first, we read the Psalms personally. We must see ourselves. Luther did this. He saw himself at verse 17. He saw himself leading up to verse 17, surrounded by bees, surrounded by enemies, surrounded by challenges. Sometimes it was Luther's friends who were his worst enemies. And of course, the papists were always out to get him. It is not hyperbole to say that Luther spent his life surrounded by enemies and having to defend himself. It's true, sometimes he was his own worst enemy and created issues. But he also was a courageous man of conviction who took bold stands. And anyone in any age, in any setting, who takes a bold stand will have enemies. It's very interesting if you go over to 1 Peter. We find there that we are to have a clean conscience against those who will call us evildoers. Isn't that interesting? That the early Christians are shored up and trying to be immunized to the challenge that the Christians are going to be called evildoers for taking a stand for truth and true goodness, and true beauty, in a culture that is committed to the opposite of all those things. It was true of the first century church that if you were a man or a woman of conviction, you would have enemies. It was true of the 16th century. It's true of the 21st. But we find so much more than that in the Psalms, don't we? What do we find in the Psalms? We find the whole range of human emotion. We find the whole range of human experience. We find the psalmist absolutely elated and full of joy and gladness. And we can relate. And we find the psalmist in absolute desperation and despair. And we can relate. We find the psalmist discouraged in his own self. And we can relate. We find the psalmist crying out, "How long, O Lord? Will you let this thing go on?" We find the psalmist at one point saying, "Why are you hidden in the clouds? How did Tom Petty put it And if you don't know who Tom Petty is, ask your parents. You don't know how it feels to be me, Tom Petty says. You don't know how it feels to be me. Oh no, the psalmist knows. The psalmist knows how it is to be you. And I'm Reformed. I am a Calvinist. Calvinists are not supposed to talk about ourselves. We're only supposed to talk about God. But the psalmist talks about human experience in a way that invites us in to see ourselves with an authenticity and an honesty. This is not saccharine. This is not Pollyanna. This is authentic human emotion that is in these psalms. And when Luther read Psalm 118, he read it for himself. He was surrounded by his enemies. He was being pushed so hard, he couldn't even feel the earth under his feet, and he just felt like he was falling. And he felt like he was going to die. But you know what else Luther sees? It's in verse 19 and 20. Look at this. Open to me the gates of righteousness, that I may enter through them and give thanks to the Lord. This is the gate of the Lord. The righteous shall enter through it. Isn't that beautiful? Not for Luther. This is the problem. Let's think about this. This is a righteous gate into a righteous city of the perfectly pure, righteous God. Now, what's the problem? I'm not righteous. I don't belong. I can't come into the presence of God, and how dare I enter a righteous gate? You know, there's a moment in Luther's life where he said, I hate God. Everybody else in his era was content to have a rather low view of God. They had such a low view of God that they thought somehow on their own merit they could level up to God's expectations. They had such a low view of God that they thought somehow they could merit his favor by their righteousness. But not Luther. He knew what a chasm existed between a holy, righteous, pure God who dwells in light, inaccessible, and the darkness of the human heart, and the utter sinfulness of the human being. And nothing Luther ever could do, no matter how white-knuckled he came at it, nothing he could ever do would allow him to approach a holy God. And so what does he say? I hate this righteous God. Luther didn't stand outside the righteous gates to the righteous city, to the presence of the righteous God, and leap with joy. He stood there and he wept. And he got angry. We must see ourselves in the Psalms. We see the full range of human emotion. We see the full range of sinfulness, don't we? It's the historical books that give us the account of David's massive, cataclysmic fall with Bathsheba. But it's the Psalms that pierce into his soul of confession. It's in the Psalms that we truly see ourselves as we are, and now we can see Christ. From our finitude, our sheer finiteness, and from our sinfulness, from that vantage point, we cry out, I need a substitute. And we find one. Look at verse 21. Now we turn the corner. Verses 17 to 20, we see ourselves. Now verses 21 on to verse 26, we see Christ. I thank you, verse 21, that you have answered me and have become my salvation. The Word made flesh for us and for our salvation. Now, turn the page or turn to the next verse. Now you know this is talking about Christ, because verses 22 to 26 are some of the most messianic terrain in all of the Old Testament. This first verse we bump into in verse 22, it's quoted 5 times in the New Testament. One of the most quoted texts in the New Testament. The stone that the builders rejected has become the cornerstone. This is Christ. This is the one who takes us by the hand, takes our unrighteousness. What a deal. We give him our unrighteousness. Sometimes we say we come to Christ with an empty hand. That's actually not true. Our hands are full of unrighteousness and guilt and shame. We don't come to Christ empty-handed. We give him our sin. We give him our unrighteousness. We give him, as the Bible describes it, our filthy rags. And what does he give us? His righteous robe. His righteous robe. Look at verse 26. Does this sound familiar? Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. It's Palm Sunday. It's Jesus' entry into the city that inaugurates Passion Week. This is some of the most messianic territory in the entire Bible. And it is this Christ who has become our salvation. It is this God-man who is our substitute. And then look in between. This is the Lord's doing. It is marvelous in our eyes. I use that verse all the time. You probably use that verse. We use it all the time. I'm sure even Dr. White uses that verse when he looks out around this beautiful campus and he says what? This is the Lord's doing. It is marvelous in our eyes. We're in the middle of a building project down at our place. Every time I go out there and I see it and I stand in front of it, I say, this is the Lord's doing. It is marvelous in our eyes. Luther said, you're taking that verse out of context. It's the cross. It's Jesus, the cornerstone that has been rejected. It has a very specific application as Luther interprets this psalm. This moment of Christ securing our redemption, this incarnation, this God-man from incarnation to the cross, to the resurrection, to the ascension. This is the Lord's doing, and it is marvelous in our eyes. I still think college presidents can use it to talk about buildings, but Luther is helping us see this is about Christ. And look at the next one. We use this all the time, don't we? This is the day that the Lord has made. Let us rejoice and be glad in it. This is the day that the Lord has made. Let us rejoice and be. This is that song, that Christian song that has made you all to just be happy all the time. You know this? And we do the sing-song echo thing. That happy, clappy Christian thing. This is the day. Let us rejoice. I remember I had a roommate in college. It was a long, long time ago. I was so glad to move on from my college roommates to my wife. Excellent roommate choice. But I remember having a college roommate, and this was a, you know, one of these, this was when they were actually dorms with bunk beds and 6 guys in a room, and one of them was always a little bit prone to depression until he got a girlfriend, and then every morning, this is the day that the Lord has made. Let us rejoice and be glad in it. And you just want to, in your Christian sanctification, reach out and, I won't say it. You know what Luther says? This day of salvation, this day of redemption, this day of the cross, this is the day that the Lord has made. Let us rejoice and be glad in it. Please apply verses 23 and 24 to anything you want. But also, please remember what Luther would say. Think of these in light of what Christ has done. Think of that glad day when he secured your redemption. And all of those other depressing days begin to take on a new perspective. It's hard, isn't it, every day to rejoice in the day that the Lord has made. But when we see Christ, we get a little perspective on the day. Well, we've seen ourselves and we see Christ, and finally, as the psalm comes to an end, now we see God. Notice it at verse 27, the Lord is God. Now that's a redundancy. Why is it here? Why does the psalmist put this way? And it's not only here, it's all through the Psalms. You trip over this, the Lord is God, the Lord is God, the Lord is God. What is the psalmist trying to tell us? The psalmist is trying to tell us here what we can only call the godness of God. The psalmist wants us to have such a vision of God, such a capacious vision of God, that it fills all things. It sucks up the oxygen out of the room, takes the space. The early theologians had an expression for God. They actually adopted it from the Greeks, a great Latin expression, ens perfectissimus. Ens means being. You can gather what perfectissimus means, perfect being. But unlike English, where we don't pile on superlatives, we don't say gooder, it's good. And we don't say bestest, it's just best. Latin doesn't suffer from that. We don't say perfectest, and we never would say most perfectest, but that's a translation of perfectissimum. The most perfectest being. This is the God we see in the Psalms, dwelling in inaccessible light. We can never have a high enough view of God. It was years and years, decades ago, David Wells wrote, "The problem with the American church is this: God rests too casually on the shoulders of the American church." The problem with American Christianity is we have too low a view of God. It was a few years ago, there were a bunch of theologians that wanted to tell us that God knows everything about the present and the past, but he doesn't know about the future. And why would we want a God who knows about the future? We want a God who participates in life with us and is waiting to see how things unfold just like we are. These were evangelicals. This is not the God of the Bible. This is not the view of God that we should have. I don't want a God like me. I don't need a God like me. That's what friends are for. That's what family is for. I need a God who is unlike me. And this is the God we encounter in the Psalms. The Lord is God, and he has made his light to shine upon us. Never miss the necessity of sacrifice for us to come to this God. Bind the festal sacrifice with cords up to the horns of the altar. Oh, this is hard. God stayed Abraham's hand, but he did not stay his own against his own son. Never lose sight of the sacrifice that enables us to walk into the presence of a holy God. And then the psalmist says, you're not some abstract principle. No, you are my God. And we get into this great Hebrew parallelism. You are my God, and I will give thanks to you. You are my God, I will extol you. You are my God. And what is left for me but to be grateful, to give gratitude to God, or give thanks to the Lord for what he is good. This is our God, this good God who loves you, who spared not his own son. For steadfast love endures forever. And that's why we need a God unlike us. We can't have steadfast love that endures forever. We are mutable beings. We change. we sometimes are faithless. We disappoint our friends, don't we? We let down our roommates. Even your faculty sometimes disappoint you on the pedestal that they are on. But not God. He alone, the good, perfect being, he alone is covenant loyal to you. He is immutable. That's not just a doctrine that you need to learn and put on the shelf. Because God is immutable, there is no shadow of turning in him. And because he is immutable, he is always and everywhere faithful to you. This is the God that we see in the Psalms. This is our God. Let's pray. Our Father and our God, we thank you for this text. We thank you for your servant Luther, who reminds us how to read this text. So often we do see ourselves in these Psalms with all sorts of emotions, and sometimes we don't even know what to do with them. So we express them to you. We thank you for this sacrifice that was made on our behalf, this gift of love that enables us, a sinful, unrighteous people, to walk right through that righteous gate and right into your very presence. And we thank you that you are our good God. Help us to behold you every day, to look deeply into your word, to see you. And may we give you thanks. Pray these things in Christ's name. Amen.